Hello, and welcome to AgTech So What, brought to you by the Agthentic Group. I'm your host, Sarah Nollet. Ask any farmer how important water is, and you'll hear just how much it contributes to their success. So surely, irrigation technology would be a lucrative field for investors and AgTech developers, right? Well, sort of, but it's not that simple. Though the technology is rapidly improving, we're just not seeing adoption. One recent European study found that 3/4 of farmers irrigate based on previous experience. That's a far cry from the promise of data-driven decisions, let alone fully automated systems. Here at AgTech So What, we've been digging into the AgTech adoption dilemma when it comes to irrigation. We just released a report specifically looking at how psychology drives farmer decision-making, and how we need to better understand psychology, not just technology, to see more uptake. To be clear, we're not blaming farmers, not at all. Farmers are humans, and we're all susceptible to behavioral patterns, such as fearing loss more than valuing gains.
I believe it was loss aversion is what you're alluding to, where we're more scared of what we have to lose versus what there is to gain. And you start to shift that around, and you can flip that around and make the conversation a lot more progressive.
That's Shane Thomas, who co-authored the Irrigation Report with us. He's an agronomist based in Canada who writes an unmissable weekly newsletter called Upstream Ag Insights. Shane joined us for a small group discussion on how these psychological phenomena play out in irrigation tech. We wanted to focus on water because, well, it's a massive issue and therefore an opportunity. As an example, in some cases today, as much as 60% of the water withdrawn for irrigation doesn't even reach the crop. It's lost through leakage, spillage, infiltration, or evaporation. It seems obvious to say that tech can help, but when you're talking about such a critical business decision, it's understandable that farmers don't always feel comfortable relying on apps or algorithms. Also joining us is Ewan Friday, Chief Investment Officer at Kilter Rural. Kilter manages more than $400 million worth of Australian farmland, water, and ecosystems, and has a strong interest in cutting-edge technology as a way of delivering environmental gains and investor returns.
So the underlying premise to this whole conversation is that the business case stacks up. Now, the business case is there and it stacks up, and you get a return on capital by implementing the technology, but there's an impediment because it's psychology.
Ewan has seen how psychology can be a barrier many times, particularly given that changes to irrigation often require large upfront costs, and yet the returns don't come for many years down the track.
Well, if you think about subsurface drip tape implementation, it's a pretty expensive technology to put in the ground, and that's probably the major impediment, even though you might get, I'm not sure, on cotton. You know, cotton's a big row cropping user of water in this part of the world, and no doubt, you know, you can grow cotton more efficiently with subsurface drip tape than you can on furrow irrigation. But the cost of perhaps putting in furrow irrigation, laying out your fields from scratch is, I don't know, $3,000 a hectare. And to put in subsurface drip tape at scale, you're probably more like $8,000 to $8,500 a hectare if you have tape that's got any sort of lifespan. So, you know, you've got that significant expense to deal with in terms of capital that you need to get that return on. And so it might be depending on where you are and how you operate it, but it could be a 10, 20% reduction in water use. And making that case, again, it's the benefits come down the track, but the costs are up front.
Along with upfront costs, Ewan says another impediment to ag tech adoption is that farmers sometimes don't value their own time.
So if they're out there and they're running the system and they're not really taking account of the time that is involved in doing that, and that could be saved through automation and through implementation of technology to make things a lot more streamlined, then they're not necessarily crystallizing in their own mind the benefits that would come from that. But from our perspective, when we're looking at, you know, running operations where we are, you know, really paying for labor by the hour, then we're highly incentivized to look for technology that makes it both more efficient in terms of productive outcome, but also a lot more efficient in terms of labor utilization as well.
That's a great point that Ewan makes there in terms of farmers valuing time. And I think it goes to the heart of that adoption point, which is often there is a confusion between the user and the customer. And so a person who doesn't value their time doesn't value a product that saves them time.
That's Matthew Pryor, my business partner. Before that, though, he co-founded a water management startup called Observant, which was ultimately acquired by the Indian irrigation manufacturing giant Jane Irrigation back in 2017. This has given Matthew unique insights into what does and doesn't motivate growers to adopt technology and change their behavior when it comes to water.
And so trying to charge them money for a product that saves them time is a circular argument that you're always going to lose. For sure, the farmer is the beneficiary of that improved use. But if we can't crack the code on how to get to that improved use, then we see no impact. And while we have that confusion about the kind of business model that motivates versus, you know, the end user that kind of participates, that's one of the main problems that we were trying to highlight in the report is it's not just as simple as the technology. If they're just as happy to kind of keep doing what they're doing, then we haven't solved the total problem. The total problem is, what is it that's going to motivate the behavioral change? And it can't be a conversation about, hey, pay us $100 a week and we'll save you 4 hours.
Matthew, tell us a little bit more about that. Like, you've been on the development side of this technology and trying to sell this to farmers. Do you have a story or an example of where, or kind of your personal journey of thinking it might work like that and you could actually sell that and then realizing that's not true?
Yeah, I mean, I think even moving out, say even just from straight irrigation to broadly water management, the very first use case was around water management in livestock and in the large systems in Australia. You have people who are employed almost exclusively to drive a truck around and peer out the door of the truck at a trough full of water to see whether there's water in there. And they will rack up, you know, hundreds, if not thousands of kilometers a week in doing so. So in the first instance, you know, that you might say, oh, well, look, that's such a waste of time, you know, install this system and you'll save time. And the reality is that this was never a motivator. But when you reframe that in terms of looking at the actual diesel use, right? And you're literally comparing, this is money that you will spend, right? Now, and so when you reframed the conversation to say, look at all the jobs that that person didn't do and look at the liters, literally the hundreds of liters of diesel that you'll save, and that completely changes the motivation because it's not about that person's there and they're there on station, you know, and they're 100 kilometers away from anything else. So talking about saving their time isn't helpful, but reframing the conversation about the maintenance job that didn't get done and the 150 liters of diesel at $2 a liter that won't get burned unnecessarily, and yet the livestock will still be safe.
You were nodding there. Do you?
Well, I've got a question I wanted to ask Matt, and I wonder, because I don't have the experience of trying to sell irrigation technology in different parts of the world, whether a functioning water market that gives people, you know, actual cost of the water that they buy or the, you know, visible opportunity cost of the water that they're using, you know, every day, whether that has driven different outcomes in terms of uptake of technology.
Yeah, I mean, again, we kind of teased at this, and I think that of all places, Australia should be the place where that's most true, and yet we haven't seen that. So theoretically, it's true, and practically, especially for temporary water, every megaliter you save is a megaliter that you can market, and so there is a real economic value. But I think, certainly my experience has been, it's the time period between when you make the decision to when the economic outcome is available to you that's the problem. It's not that the dollars don't stack up.
But there are, of course, examples of irrigation tech that is being adopted. And a big key has been a flexible business model that helps to maximize profitability. Here's Ewan again.
We've certainly come to the view that it's sort of horses for courses, different technology for different crops. So, you know, we got to a situation where we'd moved from having people up in the middle of the night going around opening gates to get water out to operating the entire system from their iPads. And, you know, it's a huge difference to both quality of life, OH&S, all sorts of both monetary and intangible benefits that come from the adoption of the technology. Ultimately, it's all about whether you can make it pay. So we're always desperately looking for ways to lower the cost of this technology adoption. looking at different ways. In fact, we've been using different models, like a higher model on cheap surface tape that we can recycle with the manufacturer to be growing things like organic processing tomatoes. We can't grow them in the same place more than, you know, once. So we've sort of got into a total cost of supply model where they'll give us, you know, we'll keep the pumps and the head mains and they'll give us the tape on a, essentially a fee for service basis. And we just factor that into our gross margin and say, okay, that's that. We roll it all up at the end, it goes back and gets recycled. So, yeah, there's obviously different models being developed. And at the end of the day, it's all about, you know, that gross margin that you can generate.
That's a great example of that kind of business model flexibility. We'd love to see it go further. We'd love to see them actually go into the business of supplying you water, but I think that that's a really good example.
Let's bring in Inge Biskoner now. Formerly with Toro Ag, Inge has a farming background and today is an irrigation consultant with Surf and Earth Enterprises. She's also a director at the Irrigation Association, bringing 40 years of experience in helping farmers become better irrigators. Inge argues that the key to getting more irrigation technology used on farms lies in education.
We have all this wonderful technology, and I often say there's a tsunami of technology coming to agriculture, and especially in irrigation, which is my area of expertise. But we often forget about, you know, hand feeding it to the actual farmer that needs to use it, and the technology is lost. So we really need to help either, you know, educate or onboard our technology in a better way to have it used to its maximum potential. For instance, when a farmer buys a drip irrigation system, it operates a lot differently than probably the former flood irrigation system. And it may be the best irrigation system in the world, but if that farmer is not taught how to determine when to schedule the irrigations according to agronomic principles like ET, you know, how much water is the crop using and how much water is my system applying, if they aren't taught that, then the system itself, some people end up running their drip irrigation system similar to the way they did their flood systems, you know, irrigating for three solid days every 2 weeks. And that is not the way to operate a state-of-the-art drip irrigation system. So either the dealer who sells the system or the manufacturer who supplies the equipment historically has had the task of transferring that technology over and training the person in charge on the farm to utilize the technology appropriately. But in my view, I think the role really belongs with a future irrigation consultant who specializes in this and who the farm hires for this purpose. Because, you know, the irrigation dealers are great in constructing systems and the manufacturers are great in innovation and inventing new technologies, sprinklers, drip, pumps, valves, sprinklers, and so forth, but not necessarily agronomic principles of how to use the system. So I believe that there is the opportunity for a skill set to fill that gap.
As an agronomist, Shane can certainly relate to this gap in the industry around irrigation skills and knowledge.
When I started agronomy, which wasn't really that long ago, call it 10 years ago, we were really using what we call the Dutch auger. So you put your probe in the ground, do the hand moisture test, and you're like, well, you know, it's 80% to capacity and we need to put on an inch or whatever it might be and do a circle. And right now where we've really just started to see things going and is to just start using moisture probes in the ground to really better understand where they're at from a moisture in the soil profile perspective, but then starting to actually couple that with an understanding of what's actually going on with that crop. But there's still the challenges with that, where I was talking with a friend just the other day, and he's like, I'm using all these soil moisture probes, but then I still can't even perfectly align with the guy that is going to turn on the pivot at the right time. And then he's overrunning the sprayer over here. And so you still run into these same challenges, even with this incremental technology. And so that's where there needs to still be some of these other incentives in place so that there is actually the incentive, I guess, in general, to get somebody in place to focus specifically on that or invest in some other technology that's going to more seamlessly automate that or alert you to it, even from that perspective.
Inge, you're nodding there. Does that resonate with you?
Yes, it does. As far as the automation part and the technology, I've had people say that the only way we're going to succeed is if we make an irrigation system similar to the thermostat in a person's home, where you just set it on the temperature that you're comfortable with and the machine in the background or in the attic will do what it needs to do to make that happen. and that really you need to take the human out of it to get this automation to work. And I, you know, in agriculture and growing crops, maybe someday, but not right now. I think farmers are never going to let some artificial intelligence determine when to make what is a crucial decision on a very expensive enterprise. And the farmer is the CEO of the farm, and they're juggling a lot of different stuff. You know, they've got the finance and the mechanics, the agronomics, and then this thing called irrigation, for instance. And I foresee that we're just going to have specialized experts and hopefully some young 1 to 2 year college degree program type folks. I don't think you need a 4-year degree or a PhD or higher level education to do some of the things that are needed to do on the farm these days. And I see some of the junior colleges stepping up and offering programs to help with that. And I see that as one of the critical things.
Another major shift that Inge is starting to see is water not only as a major driver for farming decisions, but also becoming the key unit of measurement on farm, and in some cases, becoming even more valuable than the land.
I was on the board of the California Irrigation Institute, and our sole purpose was to host a yearly conference. One of the farmers that I had recruited to speak at that conference 1 year really had a innovative approach to managing his large family's farm in Central California. And it was evolving from the typical, hey, what is our yield per acre, but yield per acre or yield per hectare, to a yield per unit of water, because water was then becoming more valuable and more scarce. And they were making farm decisions on what they were going to grow and what they were going to plant, what the enterprise was going to produce, based on which crop generated the most return per acre foot of water. The water was more valuable than the land. And yes, that's happening, I think, over the whole world.
In this part of the world, well, we haven't done the numbers for a while, but when we did, and it was probably about 6 or 7 years ago, we sort of worked out that the value of the water in the Southern Murray-Darling Basin was worth about 3 times the value of the land that it irrigated. And I bet, given the appreciation in water that's occurred over the last 5 years, that it would probably more like a multiple of 5 today. Land isn't the limiting factor here. Water's the limiting factor. And so being able to use it efficiently so that you can add value to it, that's what the model is. The thing in Australia, where you do have a functioning water market, you can see every day exactly what the cost of the water is that you're using. So you do get increasingly rational behaviour from farmers who say, well, if it's $300 a megalitre, and that's my expectation as to what it's going to be for the rest of the season, I'm not going to grow a rice crop and turn $300 worth of water into $150 worth of rice. And so, you know, it works. We see rice crops grow from 50,000 tonnes to probably 600, 650,000 tonnes this year, because there's, you know, a lot more water around, and it'll shrink back to 50,000 tonnes again once water prices go up again. So, you know, you get real response to that. One of the things I'm really interested in going forward, and Inge touched on it, is that these are really critical decisions that farmers are making about when they water and how much they water. And hopefully we'll see a future where, you know, we've been talking about the impact of big data for a while, that sort of technology where you've got low-cost monitoring feeding information in to systems that can then be presented to the farmer in a really intelligible form that can assist that decision-making process. That must be where the real opportunity for optimization is. Know how to put out water very precisely, but it's how much and when that's the real question for planned optimization.
Yeah, and the farmer doesn't need more data. What they need is a recommendation based on maybe an algorithm or whatever, but they need a cut to the chase. What does all of this mean? And if they don't have time to absorb it or learn it, then maybe this technician, this on-farm technician, can help with that. I'm wondering, if I may ask a question, we're representing different countries here today. Do you in the other countries also have what I call these silos? You know, you have your irrigation experts over here, and actually they're more engineering and technical, as opposed to your agronomic silo over here that's concerned with plant fertility and seeds and soil and maybe irrigation and water, but not so much. And I see one of the major challenges is marrying these two fields of expertise and getting them together. And in my position at the Irrigation Association out of Washington, D.C., I'm advocating for that, that we reach out to the agronomists because they need us and we need them to integrate water with, because really the water is the most important part of the agronomic puzzle. You know, I have a very good friend who's one of the premier crop doctors here in California. He says 80% of his field calls are for a farmer saying, hey, come out, my crop is sick. You know, I've got yellow leaves, something's wrong. It's not bugs or disease or fertility. It's the water. It's poor irrigation management, overwatering, too wet, maybe soil and water interactions. So we need the agronomists and the irrigators to get together. And so is that true in your countries as well?
Absolutely.
It's a yeah. worldwide problem then.
I think so. Engineers are agronomists or agronomists. You know, trying to get them together is, you know, that's the job of the farmer.
And we saw a really specific version of that, and I actually saw it as much in Australia and the US, where because the, like say, if you talk about a drip system, because the drip system was designed by engineers, it's like laid out linear, and the number of valves is the minimum number required to deliver the water. The agronomist comes in later on, it's like, well, but that soil type is different to that soil type. Yes. Why did you put the valve there? Right. If you exactly. want to, because the problem that I think a related problem is you get an insight that you can't implement. Right. Because it's like, well, actually, we need to put a different amount of water down this part of the field than that part of the field. And yet the design of the irrigation system simply doesn't allow it because of the placement of the valves. Now, I think to translate, like, to get this back to stuff that's actionable to farmers, I think, you know, be more demanding of combining those skills up front, right? As much as possible, understand that you have to combine the agronomic and the technical stuff really at the design stage. So yes. don't spend new money unless you're sure how those co-benefits are going to be delivered alongside each other, I think is a super important point.
The point you made about the thermostat, and you really resonated, because one of the things we've been joking about in writing this report is that Silicon Valley ruined ag tech, which I can probably say because I'm from there, I guess, and you only sort of believe that. But this idea, you can imagine a tech company going to pitch an investor and being like, just like our thermostat, we need to automate all of this and take the human out of it and remove the emotion and just turn the temperature to what you want and abstract away from it. And anyone who's worked in agriculture knows exactly how wrong that answer actually is. But from an investor perspective, it's so compelling to be like, yeah, of course that makes sense. Like tech can just do it and we'll have the technology make it work. But until you get out on the field, you realize that's not really the approach. I'd be curious, maybe a quick answer from all of you on advice for farmers who are thinking about irrigation technology. So that was a great point around get your team together and really understand what the requirements are. Other tips that you'd have for farmers looking at what is a complex, evolving, and crowded irrigation tech space? Ingi, we'll start with you.
I actually feel a lot of, we're all experts in our little fields and they have to absorb a lot very quickly. So the number one piece of advice I would give is to, yes, have that long conversation with your irrigation system technology provider at the onset of your project. And I think it's incumbent on the industry, and I include the commodity groups as well, to help coach their growers on how to do that. I mean, it may be as simple as, hey, are you going to want to use your irrigation system for habitat management around your farm? I mean, hedgerows, or is it for climate control as well? And the whole thing about the soils, you know, are we going to need to valve the system separately for soils? And are you going to have different crops? And are they going to have different spacings? And what's the timing on all this? So it's very complex, which is precisely why a thermostat is not going to work, at least not right now, until AI gets a lot more intelligent.
Ewan?
Well, I guess I'd just suggest you start with the soil. I mean, that's, as much as it's about water, your growing medium is the most important thing after that. So making sure that you understand that well and that you're thinking about the irrigation technology that's most appropriate for the soils that you're operating in. I'd then say keeping it simple. You know, we always just use one supplier generally. That means you can keep spares. Everybody understands the systems. It just makes it easier for people to then operate it. And I guess the third thing would be to say, keep good records, it's an iterative process. You need to actually be able to go back and understand what worked and why. And it's very difficult. Now, none of us actually have that greater memory, as it turns out. And so you actually need to be able to go back and understand, well, what was the difference? What did we do differently? And what was the outcome? So that'd be probably my three takeaways.
Awesome. Shane, any advice you'd provide from the report and the discussion today and your experience?
Water drives everything. That's your nitrogen use efficiency, your boron uptake, all these different things, mineralization, all that gets driven by moisture. And so if you can start to understand how strong water applications and water management can actually help to manage your nitrogen applications and your output from that, I think that goes so far. And it just comes down to measuring it, recording it, and then actually thinking about it and looking at it and doing a check, whether it's on a weekly basis or on the end of the year basis, just to really see how did you do and how did it compare on a per crop basis, or even to different varieties, which doesn't always get talked about. That's the agronomist in me that starts to look at those sorts of things. So I think, yeah, it just comes back to really focusing in on that measurement, because from there, the old adage, if you don't measure it, you can't manage it, or something along those lines, that's so true. And just something that's so key is we talk about technology and everything progressing, because obviously technology often allows us to measure more, but if we're not actually doing anything incremental with that, it can be challenging.
Matthew?
I think in our How Silicon Valley Destroyed Ag Tech theme, I think the what we're trying to say there is that the technology often has a first order impact. Like the person who uses it is the person who sees the benefit. And a lot of Silicon Valley style innovation is delivered that way. I think a lot of the insight that was missing in a lot of first and even second generation ag tech is that it's the supply chain impact that you have to. You've got to look at the total supply chain impact, because often the money is somewhere else. So I think that would be the advice. If you're looking at practice change, to Ewan's point, if it's about soil, or if it's about, you know, exactly where water can be saved, look at who else in the supply chain is really going to back you in that change. So if it's about lower input of water and lower input of nitrogen, it's going to be less runoff, it's going to be better protected waterways, and so you've probably got really strong allies in the natural capital space, or, you know, your downstream suppliers who might have a really strong water stewardship program. So it's not just within the confines of my property, how much water could I save, or how much time could I save? Just that idea that we could manifest this water as tomatoes, or we could sell it to the people who can't do without it at the times. That level of flexibility, that kind of lateral thinking along the supply chain, I think is really where you have to focus first. And then when you've understood that, your on-farm investment decisions, I think, are going to be much better directed.
So we've heard about some of the state of the tech and problems today, but what can we expect for the future of irrigation technology? Instead of more tech, we believe that what will actually accelerate the adoption is an evolution in how the technology is being positioned and brought to market. I asked the group for their final thoughts. Here's Matthew.
I think the things to look out for are consolidation, and using that consolidation to broaden the view on business model. So, you know, we've observed that there's been a couple of generations of investment in irrigation ag tech, and, you know, there's been an awful lot of money and nowhere nearly as much returned. And, you know, we can already see examples of acquisitions, of consolidations. And when you can kind of get that stacked functionality, then I think you can expand the reach from clearly differentiating the user from the customer, the kind of beneficiary from the economic, the sort of functional beneficiary from the economic beneficiary. So I think that's really where we're going to be super interested to see the market play out.
Thanks. Shane?
The most interesting part, I guess, for me that I'll be watching is just that we hear a lot about all the carbon space, and there's a lot of focus on the ESG and just really how will some of this play out across the globe when it comes to how water plays into that, how we talk about carbon credits, how will water be associated with that, and how will that be driven. And I think as we see some of the feasibility of some of these technologies come to fruition, I guess just around better understanding of what's going on in the soil, as Ian alluded to, the cost coming down in theory as we get better, call it, capability to deliver some of these different technologies, but then a better understanding of what that incremental benefit will be.
there's been a seismic shift over the last, well, even the last 18 months. You know, it's been sort of gathering, but in the last 12 months, it's almost the first base question in relation to people's consideration of investment in this space. They want to be part of the solution and not the problem. And, you know, I think if you look at agricultural emissions globally, it's around about 14% of total. But it is one of the few places that can actually play a really positive role, because everything else is avoided emissions. What we can do in ag is actually take out some of that banked carbon, and being able to play that role and having investors understand that, you know, this is, well, they're demanding that, you know, if they put their money to work in this space, that it is actually part of the solution. And I think that's going to be a really important driving force going forward.
Awesome. Thanks, Ewan. Couldn't agree more. Inge?
I think that just as the organic movement was a pipe dream and just a fringe thought 40 years ago, and now, of course, it's mainstream, I think that the consumer will always drive how our food is grown. And I think the consumer today very much cares about where their food comes from and what it's taken to grow it. And it's odd, because at no time in history has the consumer been so disconnected from their food and how it's grown and where it comes from. So they're not on the farm, but they're very interested in how it's grown. And I think that's going to drive agriculture to adopt appropriate technology to be resource efficient and appropriately grown. And we'll see similar types of certifications for food that we see in building, like LEED certification building. We have stewardship types of certifications for our food. And I also think we'll see disruption in what is grown where. For instance, where resources are scarce and expensive and you have unique climates such as California, it makes no sense to grow lower value crops. They will move elsewhere in favor of higher value crops where we are. And actually, many acres may go out of production just because of the lack of available water. So there's going to be some disruptions.
And that's it for another episode of AgTech So What. A big thank you to all of our guests, Inge Biskoner, Ewan Friday, Matthew Pryor, and Shane Thomas. Shane, of course, who collaborated with us to write the AgTech Adoption Dilemma on Irrigation. You can download the report for free from our website, agtechsowhat.com. You can also find links to other resources mentioned in this podcast and more on each of our guests. Thanks as always for listening. I'm Sarah Nolette. Catch you next time.